Welcome to Three Associating.
One is the loneliest number.
A podcast that goes behind the door of therapists working in a relational psychoanalytic model. I'm Andrew.
And I'm Rachel. We're both therapists.
And we're both supervisees of Jill.
And I'm Jill, therapist and supervisor, and co-author with Jackie Winship of the book The Talking Cure.
While people might think that therapists have it all together, by now, you know, we don't. We get stuck, experience challenges, and have blind spots.
This continues to affect our work, and this is why we need ongoing supervision.
This podcast peeks behind the closed door of relational supervision and lets you know about the therapist's blind spots. Relational supervision complements the traditional focus on the patient by focusing on both patient and the therapist.
In each episode, we discuss a fictitious character in supervision. While none of these patients are real, the relational dynamics are.
One is the loneliest.
Episode 6, An Education on Trauma, The Obliteration of Thinking and Feeling. Andy, did you ever have the experience when you were a kid at school where your friend asked you to forge their mum's signature after they jigged school?
I mean, I may have done that a few times.
So you did do it?
Well, their mother did, yeah.
Okay, good to know. Hi, Jill.
Hi, Rach.
The case I'm bringing to you today is of a woman who's 37 years old and who I've been working with for 2 years. When she came to treatment, she was having trouble in her marriage. She'd been married to a husband for 2 years, and she was ready and wanting to start a family, which he had agreed to. But then he got cold feet and changed his mind about wanting children. They argued about it for about a year, and then at some point she found out he was having an affair. So she, of course, was devastated. The marriage ended about a year ago now, and since then she's spiraled into overwhelm and has been engaging in many impulsive behaviors to manage this overwhelm. And her overwhelm seems to be mostly in relation to her biological clock and her fears that she's running out of time to meet someone and to start a family. So she's been impulsive with her spending, risky with her partying, which has included drug taking and unsafe sex, and she's been disorganized and unreliable at work. A few times she's just not fronted up to work and given no explanation. So her manager has been pretty understanding and seems sympathetic to her traumatic situation, as she puts it. But I worry that it will wear thin. So during one session, we were discussing an incident where she hadn't used protection whilst having sex a few weeks before. She reported feeling overwhelmed and scared that she might be pregnant. But this was the third time that she'd had a scare like this. And I wondered out loud with her that perhaps a part of her might wish becoming pregnant in this way, as it might mean she'll have a baby and can lose the guy, since she seemed convinced that men were interested in sex, not babies. But she seemed offended and became defensive. But just before she responded defensively, I'm sure I caught like a smile in the corner of her lips. And I didn't mention it, as I felt that I had to do some repair work and soothing in regards to her being offended and her feelings being hurt. Anyway, during our last session, she told me that she hadn't shown up for work again as she was coming down after a big weekend, and requested that I write a letter to her boss explaining that she was suffering after her traumatic divorce. And I felt a bit trapped in this moment as well. She had often referred to her divorce as traumatic. I had never used the word trauma when referring to it, and I was definitely avoiding doing so. But now it felt like we had to discuss the issue. Mm-hmm. I asked her if she believed if she was suffering from PTSD, and she said, "Of course I am. Do I need to educate you on how trauma works, Rachel?" And she said this in such a sarcastic way and was wearing what looked like some smug smile on her face. And now, I didn't really give my next comment much thought before I said it. But I said to her, oh, you look like you're having a good time over there. Are you enjoying yourself? And it was definitely a challenge. And let's just say that didn't go down very well, as you can imagine. And she became quite enraged at me and my lack of empathy and understanding. And she told me she shouldn't have to explain herself to me. And if I couldn't appreciate how traumatic these last few years had been for her, then that's my failure. And all the while, I still had the feeling that she was kind of enjoying herself and her rage towards me. Mm-hmm. And I had like this image of her jumping on the couch, like engaging in some kind of pillow fight or something, you know. I did reassure her that I absolutely understood how devastating the end of her marriage had been for her. And I could see that she was still significantly suffering and fearful in regards to her biological clock running out. And I believe that she was still grieving. And she said, grief? You think this is just grief? And I told her, I don't think grief is a small thing. You know, it's devastating. Yet this didn't feel like enough for her. Yeah, we left things with me, I guess, trying to reassure her. And I told her that I'd give some more thought to her request about the letter. But I thought something important was kind of happening, and I was committed to continuing working through this with her, but I kind of wanted to give it some more thought. And I'm at a loss, Jill, as in some way I could just say trauma is just a word, but I really feel like it carries a certain significance and weight. And she's not asking me to diagnose her with PTSD, but she is asking that I use the word trauma to describe her experience in the letter. I guess it like kind of begs the question, like, who gets to decide what's traumatic, you know? Am I the gatekeeper of the term? If she was asking for a diagnosis, I could possibly say she didn't meet criteria, but she's not asking for that. And then there's also this kind of feeling in me that she's enjoying her rage so much that in certain moments it kind of doesn't even look like suffering, you know, in those moments. And I think, of course, she must be suffering, as why else she would be putting herself at risk and in the ways that she does. But I'm not seeing a lot of it in the consulting room. And it feels to me that there's this thing, this unspoken thing just hanging in the air, which is, you don't think this is bad enough. And whilst I do think it's bad, there is some truth to that statement, you know. And I kind of, I guess I don't want to say that, but I kind of don't know what to do.
Rach, why do you think you said to her, because you said it just sort of came out spontaneously, are you having a good time? What do you think informed you in that moment?
Well, like I said, it was a challenge. I think I was annoyed.
And you were challenging her too?
I kind of feel like she was, the content of what she was saying wasn't kind of matching up with the affect in the moment. Like it kind of felt, like I said, like a smug smile, like she was kind of pleased. And I think I got sort of pulled into challenging that. And so it's sort of like there's one conversation at the level of content, and yet something else is happening on a level of the process or the sort of nonverbal in the room.
Yes. Okay. I go back to that thought as well around, and, you know, you don't think it's bad enough, which is what's hanging in the room. And I guess I'm thinking it's pretty bad.
Right.
Not in terms of, I can't say in terms of the marriage or the trauma of the marriage or what it is, but it's pretty bad because the enactments are risky. So I always feel when a patient's engaging in risky behavior, they really are broadcasting that something's pretty bad, that they can't necessarily bring into another form. So they enact something.
Sure, yeah.
Which shows them and her. And she's also not able to make good judgments around, well, if I'm really worried about my biological clock, I could freeze my eggs or I could do something that will give me more time to think. but she can't think. And to me, it's a sort of hallmark of something traumatic is that you can't think. So, I mean, whatever happened in the marriage, I don't know, but I would say that the behavioral markers of being in the aftermath of something are there. But again, I'm kind of struck by the fact that it's become a power struggle between you around whether the word will be used or it won't be used. And there's something in you that feels that she is in some sort of power dynamic with you in which she feels free to sort of harangue you and, harangue you around, well, I don't have to educate you or you don't you know anything about trauma. And in a way, it felt to me that if she were enjoying something, which is what you felt and picked up, is that probably she was enjoying your being small and not knowing, as opposed to her being small and not knowing. Because I think she's not knowing in quite a big way. She's not knowing what's going to happen next. She's not knowing what the next step is. She's not even knowing herself, perhaps, as she knew herself, because as far as I understand, all this acting out is post what happened with the affair and the husband. And, you know, an affair is quite a big betrayal. So, as you rightly point out, we can't know subjectively, you know, what one person responds to, another person doesn't. But I'm not looking at that. I'm looking at what are the behavioral markers. And it's both and. And in addition to that, I might sort of enjoy my rage in relation to you as an outlet and let you feel small and all of those things. Because I'm going to tell you, you don't know what you're doing in the way that I don't. But I think what might also be playing on your mind is that she is now making the relationship between you transactional in terms of giving that letter.
Yeah.
Because I think there is something difficult about that. And, you know, it's a bit like quite often in psychiatry, the person who is the therapy psychiatrist doesn't want to be the treating psychiatrist. And you, as the person who is doing the treatment, doesn't want to be put in a position of assessment and writing the letter. So I think that you might also, you know, when you said that to her, because it is from your side quite an aggressive comment, might be coming from the fact that she's put you into a conflicted situation where there is a kind of demand that you wear two hats, or a request at least that you wear two hats, which is problematic. So, yes, I can see also from your side what some of the difficulties might be.
Yeah, I think I've got several thoughts, but on that last point, I think the thing that I feel conflicted around is that she had a massive weekend and then she was coming down from that and then didn't go to work. And then for me to say, oh, you know, it's her traumatic divorce, it sort of doesn't feel right. Or that maybe I'm expecting more of her, or like maybe, you know,
I get it, and I totally would not myself sort of collude with that or say something untrue. I probably would say, which I do believe and would stand behind, is that, you know, since her divorce and the collapse of her relationship, she has had immense difficulties in not being overwhelmed and struggling to, you know, remain with an equilibrium. And because I do believe that.
Some fancy footwork.
Well, it is fancy footwork, but it's true. I think that she had a terrible weekend because she can't regulate her affects sufficiently. I mean, you could say to her, you know, look, it's up to you, Rach, because it's around your integrity or your authenticity. For me, I would say to the person, look, we both know that the reason, you know, for this is that you've had a big weekend. We also know that part of the reason that you're having so many big weekends is that you're disrupted and you can't really regulate your affect other than by doing these things. Mm-hmm. So I'm happy to write you a letter saying that I think it is in the aftermath of the divorce that you're having struggles. But it's, you know, on the understanding that we're going to work at finding better ways to regulate the affect.
Sure, yeah.
So I would use that therapeutically. I would feel in myself not compromising my integrity if I framed it that way, maybe fancy footwork, but I wouldn't only frame it that way. I would use it as a way of trying to get her to see.
Yeah.
These enactments are trauma products and they're dangerous and risky and you're not thinking clearly. Mm. So, okay. And I'd be clear, I'm going to do it on this occasion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I wouldn't do it every single time. I'm saying I'll do it because I think it's true. But we need to work on it.
But you would or you wouldn't use the word trauma?
I think I wouldn't get hooked on the word trauma. Personally, I wouldn't get hooked on it because it doesn't have the same charge for me, because I think the word trauma has been so overused that actually it's a bit of a meaningless word, which sometimes means that people who've had rape or murder or been burnt in fires, you know, we're kind of using the same word, but that's part of the lexicon. I probably wouldn't use the word trauma, but not out of an ideological commitment, but more because I can convey more to the boss and more to her by actually describing
what's happened,
the difficulty in keeping an equilibrium and regulating affect and being able to stay, you know, calm and focused and move forward. It says a lot more to me than using the word.
Yeah. As you're sort of talking about, you know, the fact that she's sort of not being able to be calm and thinking and she's sort of acting out in these sorts of ways, that, you know, it must be that her, I'm thinking at it in terms of like an attachment theory sort of lens, and there's something about the marriage that she was settled in, and then that relationship breakup has sort of sent her into a spin and she's sort of not able to sort of settle herself on her own.
I think that's true. I definitely think that's true. And there probably was a vulnerability around early attachment. I think you're onto that.
Yeah.
But I also think that it is a mark of trauma, real trauma, when we're talking about post-traumatic stress or the real experience of trauma, is that it's unexpected and unpredicted. And I don't believe she expected the husband to have an affair, and I don't think she predicted that her life trajectory around children and a family would be cut across like this. So from my perspective, as I say, I'm not hung up on the word, but for me there's enough in the lead-up that I feel would be predisposing her to experience the events as traumatic. And I think the way in which she's handling it, which is to act out and not think, is both protecting her from feeling the full impact, which is probably why you don't feel it in the room.
No, I don't. And I think that's what's difficult about this. I'm like, this doesn't really feel – I'm not seeing sort of – lots of devastation. Like, I'm just seeing a lot of acting out, and it's sort of...
That's the point. I think you're not feeling it because she is not allowing herself to think or feel, so she's not feeling it. She's, you know, party and, you know, have a big night and then we miss work and this and that. But that's exactly the problem. So you're not feeling it, but she's not being able to register properly, which is why she's acting out. And so, as I say, from my perspective, Rach, I do think it's trauma, but I'm not ideologically committed, because I think that I would rather describe what's happening.
Yeah.
And I would feel authentically able to do it, because that's how I experience her, you know, as having the precursors to trauma, and she's showing sequelae of trauma. But I would still want to be able to then say, yes, okay, we're going to write the letter, but this is how I see it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we really need to be working on it because time, you know, is marching on and this is not serving you in terms of your own long-term goals.
Yeah, around the biological clock and wanting a family,
You okay to end there?
Yeah, I am.
Well, I hope I'm not cutting you short,
Rach. No. This has given me a lot to think about, so yeah. Thanks, Tim.
Okay. Good.
Now we reflect on what happened. We identified the dilemma we took into the supervision, the distillation we took out of supervision, and our blind spots.
Blind spots include bright spots and dark spots. A bright spot is when we are blinded to the overall picture and we can only see a sliver of what is occurring in ourselves and in the interaction. A dark spot is when the issues are more completely out of sight.
So, Rach, what was the dilemma for you going into this supervision session?
Well, it was, I don't think this is trauma, and I don't know how to say it.
Mm-hmm. And what was the distillation coming out of the session?
Well, I think that I actually did need an education on trauma.
Yeah, we all do. I mean, trauma is never something that we're completely across.
Yeah, that's for sure.
And Jill, the blind spots, what was the bright spot?
Well, I think the bright spot, Rach, was that you were caught between your fear of disrupting her and the therapy by saying no to the letter and your fear of colluding with her and her problematic behaviours by saying yes to the letter.
That's right.
And the dark spot?
I think the dark spot was that something was being enacted, something quite risky, by challenging her about her enjoyment. Meanwhile, I think, Rach, there was a bit of enjoyment on your side in the challenge itself.
No.
Which is not to say the challenge wasn't important, but it was ill-timed. And perhaps one could have framed it a little differently, but then it may not have had the same impact. But I felt there were so many other crucial issues that needed to be explored that you were caught in the enjoyment yourself.
All right, fair point.
And the learning points for you, Rach?
Well, that you can never get enough education on trauma.
Mm.
And the second one is the importance of supervision to bring in a third in order to create a space for thinking, especially when one is stuck in a stuck place and not able to do a lot of thinking in the therapy.
Mm.
And the last one is that, you know, if there's an urge towards action, like in the episode, you know, my aggressive challenge, that it's actually a signal to stop and think.
Mm-hmm. And Jill, what were the teaching points?
Well, I was thinking again about the well reiterated point that if we can't bring into awareness feelings or even a thought and register them, we'll then either enact them or they'll emerge as a symptom. So that was my first point. My second point is to state the obvious, but sometimes it's really important to state the obvious, which is that we all have an unconscious, not just the patient, and we can all get caught in the drive. Again, not just the patient. And sometimes it happens, and it's something we need to be able to think about. And then my final point was to reiterate what Rach has said, and I think is accurate, that there can be an enjoyment in rage, which is counterintuitive. But from a Lacanian perspective, when he speaks of jouissance, he's speaking of something which encompasses both pain and pleasure simultaneously. And I think that's the kind of enjoyment that is implicated sometimes in rage.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. And Rach, do you have a final question for Jill?
Yeah. In your mind, what's the difference between courageous speech and challenging a patient before thinking it through?
Well, actually, Rach, I think you've answered your own question.
Okay.
Because I think courageous speech is when one has thought it through as opposed to a risky challenging. And I think in courageous speech, you've thought it through and decided that the timing is right to bring it into the room, both in terms of your having had time to think about it and how you want to frame it, and also the timing is right for the patient to be able to absorb it. So, yes, I think challenging a patient before thinking it through, the risky challenge, is often impulsive, and one can be in the grip of the drive, which doesn't mean one can't be somewhat activated before one speaks. But from my perspective, the activation needs to be within manageable limits for both parties in the room. And I know that the issue of courageous speech is a hot topic in the relational field, and there are many different views, but that's my own view. And that is why we continue to need to be three associating.
Thank you for listening to Three Associating. Our theme song is performed by Katie Whiten, and our audio production is by Jared Young. So a big thank you to both Katie and Jared. If you have enjoyed this podcast, please leave us a rating and review on whichever platform you listen to us. We love hearing from you and appreciate all of the support we've had so far. This really helps us to continue to make new content.
Bye for now. What is the loneliest number?